I am really excited that we are going back now to the book of John. We are going back to the book of John. We've taken a four-week detour, 3 weeks on deacons, and then 1 week also Pastor Mark Chun was here speaking. And today we are continuing where we left off in the book of John, chapter 19, the second half of verse 16 to 24. And because it's been a little while, just to give a little recap about where we're picking up from, Pilate, Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor of Judea, had just been manipulated slash blackmailed by the Jewish religious leaders into condemning Jesus to death. Basically, they said that this man, Jesus, he claims to be a king. You need to put him to death. Pilate wanted to let him go. He knew that they wanted to do this because they were jealous of Jesus. Pilate didn't want anything to do with that. But the Jewish leaders said, hey, he claims to be a king. And anyone who claims to be a king is no friend of Caesar. We know that Caesar is the true king, right, Pilate? What they were saying is, if you don't take care of this insurrectionist, of this guy who has a competing claim to Caesar, we're going to make sure Caesar hears about this. And how do you think Caesar's going to feel when he finds out that you didn't deal with this guy who claimed to be king? You think he's going to be happy with you? And when Pilate heard this, he felt forced, although he wasn't, but he felt forced into condemning Jesus to death. And he sends Jesus away to be crucified. That's where we pick up today in verse 16. So I'm going to read these verses first, and then we'll come back around and look at it a little bit slower. So they took Jesus, and he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of a skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. There they crucified him, and with him two others, one on either side, and Jesus between them. Pilate also wrote an inscription and put it on the cross. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, King, the King of the Jews. Many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Aramaic, in Latin, and in Greek. So the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but rather this man said, I am King of the Jews. Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. When the soldiers had crucified Jesus, they took his garments and divided them into four parts, one part for each soldier, also his tunic. But the tunic was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. So they said to one another, let us not tear it, but cast lots for it to see whose it shall be. This was to fulfill the scripture, which says, they divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. So the soldiers did these things. This is the word of God. Here, as we come back to the top of the verse, it says that Jesus bore his own cross to the site of his crucifixion. Now, this was typically done. It was typical that the one who was condemned would carry his own cross to the place of crucifixion. Now, this was not the entire cross, whether, you know, a T-shape, capital T or a lowercase T, as we tend to see it more. But this was just the cross beam, the beam that went across called the patibulum, the horizontal part that was carried. So Jesus was carrying this horizontal piece over to the place where he was to be crucified. This place was called the place of a skull. Now, no one knows where this is, although I'm certain I haven't been out to Jerusalem, but if you go there, I'm sure there'll be various places that claim to be this is the place, and maybe they want to sell you different trinkets or souvenirs trying to claim that it's the place, but nobody knows where this place is. But theologians think that it probably looked like a skull, like there was some feature in the topography that made it look like a skull, but they're not quite sure. In Aramaic, it's called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. Now, just a bit of trivia here, the word Calvary, which is very familiar to us if you're a Christian, it comes from the Latin word Calvaria. Calvaria also means skull. So that was used in the Latin version of the Bible. So when you hear about you know, Calvary Chapel or Calvary Baptist Church or the word Calvary, it means skull, right? It means skull chapel, skull church, meaning this is the place where Jesus was crucified. So he carries his crossbeam there, the patibulum there. And then in verse 18, it says, there they crucified him. Now, I am hard pressed to find other passages in the Bible that are more understated than this. There they crucified him. It's so short. It sounds so simple. But in reality, this is the most horrific form of death that human beings have ever devised. Maybe because the people knew how horrific this was, not much needed to be said. All you need to do is say, there they crucified him, and people would shudder inside to know what happened to him, because crucifixion was common in those days under the Roman Empire. People knew what it was all about. But because we live 2,000 years later in a part of the world where crucifixion doesn't happen, unfortunately, still does happen in certain parts of this world. But because we're more separated from that, crucifixion can become very trite or cliche. So I want to read to you a description of it by Kayleen Schreier, professor, PhD professor in the Department of Biology and Chemistry at Azusa Pacific University. Now, I'm going to leave out the part here about Jesus' condition when he got to the cross, because he was already, you know, he was flogged. The whip had bits of bone in it. It would tear out skin, muscle. His back would have been shredded to ribbons, exposing bone. He would have lost so much blood that his body would have been in shock. This is the condition in which he was carrying his cross over to the place of the skull. This is how he was before he even got there. But once he got there, Dr. Schreier explains it, describes it like this. The accused needed to be nailed to the patibulum while lying down. So Jesus is thrown to the ground, reopening his wounds, grinding in the dirt and causing bleeding. They nail his hands to the patibulum. The Greek meaning of hands includes the wrist. It is more likely that the nails went through Jesus's wrists. If the nails were driven into the hand, the weight of the arms would cause the nail to rip through the soft flesh. Therefore, the upper body would not be held to the cross. If placed in the wrist, the bones in the lower portion of the hand support the weight of the arms, and the body remains nailed to the cross. The huge nail, 7 to 9 inches long, damages or severs the major nerve to the hand, the median nerve, upon impact. This causes continuous, agonizing pain up both of Jesus' arms. Once the victim is secured, the guards lift the patibulum and place it on the stipes already in the ground. As it is lifted, Jesus' full weight pulls down on his nailed wrists and his shoulders and elbows dislocate. In this position, Jesus' arms stretch to a minimum of 6 inches longer than their original length. It is highly likely that Jesus' feet were nailed through the tops, as often pictured. In this position, with the knees flexed at approximately 90 degrees, the weight of the body pushes down on the nails, and the ankles support the weight. The nails would not rip through the soft tissue as would have occurred with the hands. Again, the nail would cause severe nerve damage. It severs the dorsal pedal artery of the foot and acute pain. Normally, to breathe in, the diaphragm, the large muscle that separates the chest cavity from the abdominal cavity, must move down. This enlarges the chest cavity and air automatically moves into the lungs, inhalation. To exhale, the diaphragm rises up, which compresses the air in the lungs and forces out the air, exhalation. As Jesus hangs on the cross, the weight of his body pulls down on the diaphragm and the air moves into his lungs and remains there. Jesus must push up on his nailed feet, causing more pain to exhale. In order to speak, air must pass over the vocal cords during exhalation. The Gospels note that Jesus spoke seven times from the cross. It is amazing that despite his pain, he pushes up to say, "Forgive them." The difficulty surrounding exhalation leads to a slow form of suffocation. Carbon dioxide builds up in the blood, resulting in a high level of carbonic acid in the blood. The body responds instinctively, triggering the desire to breathe. At the same time, the heart beats faster to circulate available oxygen. The decreased oxygen due to the difficulty in exhaling causes damage to the tissues, and the capillaries begin leaking watery fluid from the blood into the tissues. This results in the buildup of fluid around the heart, pericardial effusion, and lungs, pleural effusion. The collapsing lungs, failing heart, dehydration, and the inability to get sufficient oxygen to the tissues essentially suffocate the victim. The decreased oxygen also damages the heart itself, myocardial infarction, which leads to cardiac arrest. In severe cases of cardiac arrest, the heart can even burst, a process known as cardiac rupture. Jesus most likely died of a heart attack. D.A. Carson, in his commentary on the book of John, He also adds in the detail that oftentimes on the cross there would be what was called a sedecula, which was a little wooden seat that was placed there under the person so that the person could kind of rest and lean upon it. Now, this was not a form of mercy, mind you. This was actually done to support the body weight in order to prolong the person's life and agony. It was meant to help the person fight on while hanging on the cross. It was to make this thing as long and drawn out as possible, which is why sometimes people would hang there for hours under the hot sun or even days suffering like this. It was the most terrible form of punishment humanity has ever come up with. It was excruciatingly painful, to say the least. Even the word, you know, how do you describe the most difficult, the most painful pain you can feel? What is the word we usually go to? Excruciating, right? Excruciating is from the Latin word excruciare, meaning to torment or to torture, which is a derivative of the word crux. Excruciare. Crux is a derivative of crux, referring to the cross. The next time you say that feels excruciatingly painful, what you're trying to say is that it hurts so much, but it compares nothing to the original source, the etymological meaning, the cross from which it is derived. Crucifixion was so horrible a death that Roman citizens could not be crucified. They were not allowed to be crucified unless sanctioned by the emperor himself. So if we were to think about that in today's day, if, God forbid, there was crucifixion in our country, and if, God forbid, you were arrested and you were tried and you were sent to be crucified, before you could be crucified, there would be, like, you know, the president would be sitting at his desk and a letter would be put down in front of him and it would say, "Mr. President, we want to crucify these criminals, this person," and your name would be there. And he would need to read this. And he would need to sign off on that before you could be crucified. The president would need to sign off on this before that could happen to you. This was how terrible a death this was. This was how Rome kept the subjects of its empire in line. Because this was a message to everybody. You get out of line, you go too far, and this is waiting for you. It was the most terrible form of death that one could imagine. And it says here that when Jesus was crucified, again, they crucified him, and with him two others, one on either side, and Jesus between them. In the book of Matthew, the ESV translates the two other people as robbers. It says they're robbers, they're criminals. It is hard to imagine that John, when he wrote this, did not think about Isaiah chapter 53, verse 12, when he wrote that, where it says, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered among the transgressors. I believe that John must have been thinking about Isaiah's prophecy here and how that was fulfilled in the life of Jesus. This innocent man was numbered with these criminals, these robbers. He was numbered among the transgressors. And you see, this fact that he was numbered among the transgressors as well points not just to the ultimate horror and pain and suffering that was brought about by crucifixion, but to the shame of it as well. Because crucifixion was extremely public. It was extremely public. And along with the pain, it was meant to humiliate you before the masses, before everybody. That was very much a part of the design of crucifixion. This was not done in private. This is not like, you know, in America, in some parts of our country, there can be electrocution, the death penalty, and maybe 10 people walk into a room to witness this. Maybe officials, the person who was family members of somebody who was murdered maybe by this person, they go in there, it's a private affair, and they witness the person being executed. No, this happened in front of everybody. In front of everybody. It was meant to be widespread public humiliation. This is why there was a sign that was put on top of Jesus. And it said, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. It was a broadcast of his crime. Oftentimes, the person on the way to the cross would have this sign hung around his neck. Jesus, as he was heading to the cross, may have had a sign there that said, around his neck, saying, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. And after he was crucified, that sign was fastened to the top of the cross. It says here in verse 20 that many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city. It was near the city. Again, not out in the field, not somewhere far away because this was so terrible of an end for somebody, but this was done near the city so that as people passed, they would see it. So that people could easily go out there and see this if they wanted to. Because, hey, did you hear? Somebody's being crucified. It's right outside the city. Let's go. Let's watch this. Not only did friends and family sometimes come out to mourn a loved one who was hanging upon the cross, but enemies would come to gloat, to insult the person, to sit there and have a little picnic and watch as their enemies suffered upon the cross. It was a public spectacle of a death. And it says that the sign that was placed above Jesus was written in Aramaic, in Latin, and in Greek. Why? Because Aramaic, this was the common language of the people of Judea. It was written in Latin also. This was the official language of the army and of the Roman Empire. And it was also written in Greek because that was the lingua franca. That was like the language most used throughout the Roman Empire. And it was also well known in that region in Galilee. The reason that this was written in every language there that people understood was because the Romans wanted everybody to know. They wanted everybody to understand why this person was hung up there. The nature of his crime. This was a public humiliation. And not only that, but the fact that Jesus' garments were split amongst his executioners goes to show that Jesus was hanging on the cross most likely naked as well. Humiliation upon humiliation upon humiliation. Ultimate pain and suffering and ultimate humiliation before the eyes of the people. This was, talk about cruel and unusual punishment. This is as bad as it got. No wonder that the chief priests, the religious leaders, they came to Pilate and they said to him, "Do not write the King of the Jews, but rather this man said, 'I am King of the Jews.'" Why did they come to him with this claim? Because what they're saying is, Pilate, that man is not our king. We want nothing to do with this shameful wretch hanging upon our cross. This is embarrassing. He is not our king. Instead, could you please add something up there that says, he said, this is what he claimed. He claimed that he is our king, but he isn't really our king. Now, Pilate responds to this by saying, what I have written, I have written. Now, talk about an unhelpful response. What in the world? This is like the first recorded history of somebody saying, it is what it is, right? You know, I hate that saying, it is what it is, because what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. I know it is what it is, but why is it what it is, right? It is what it is, doesn't help me. Pilate says, what I have written, I have written. And this is an enigmatic statement by him. What does he mean by this? What I have written, I have written. I think there are a couple of main views that theologians hold about this. And the first view is this. They think that Pilate is trying to get back at the religious leaders. He's trying to say, you guys blackmailed me, manipulated me, made me feel the fool, play the fool. Well, I'm gonna have the last laugh. So, King of the Jews, he's your king. Look at that. And he put that sign up there. Now, that is certainly possible. But there's a second possibility here that I think has a lot of merit as well. And the second possibility is this. It's that Pilate, actually, when he wrote this, in some way, without understanding deeply what is going on in his heart, he actually meant, in some way, what he wrote. That this is the king of the Jews. Why do I say that? Well, because if you recall earlier in the chapter, after Jesus' arrest, when he's interrogating Jesus, it starts off with just like, oh, this guy, he's some insurrectionist, he's somebody they want killed for whatever reason. He's interrogating Jesus, trying to find out why, what's going on. And then this claim that he's a king. He says, are you a king? And Jesus says, you said so yourself. And then Pilate says, are you a king? Tell me, who are you? And then Jesus says that my kingdom is not of this world. Now he replies in a really, really strange way. He says he's a king, but he's a king of a kingdom that is not here in this world. Now that's kind of like throwing Pilate for a loop. What in the world are you talking about? A non-earthly kingdom? What does that mean? And then things get really crazy for him because when he's outside and he's arguing with the religious leaders again and they're pushing for Jesus to be crucified, they said to him, we have a law. And according to that law, he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God. Now it says there that when Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid. So he was afraid before, but he was even more afraid now. And he went back into Jesus and he said, who are you? Where are you from? Something within Pilate, why would this man who had so much power be scared? Because I think there was something within him that said, what if this man is a king? What if he is a king that is not of this world? What if he actually is a son of God or the son of God walking amongst us as Romans believed and Greeks believed in those times could happen? He thought, could this man actually have divinity within him? And not only this, but while he was judging Jesus as well, deciding what to do with him, a messenger came and said, your wife sent you a message. And the message said, have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream. A supernatural message comes to Pilate. His wife had a dream. They certainly believed that God or the gods spoke through dreams and visions, and they did things like that. And his wife said to him, I had a dream that this man is a holy and righteous man. I've been suffering in this dream because of him. Leave him alone. Don't have anything to do with him. He's innocent. He's righteous. How do you think Pilate felt after that? Probably scared out of his mind. What am I about to do here? Now, we know in the end that the pragmatism of Pilate got the best of him, and he feared Caesar more than he feared what he could be doing to Jesus and who Jesus truly could have been. And he sent Jesus to the cross. But on that sign, he wrote, the King of the Jews. when he said, what I have written, I have written. What I believe he's saying, what he's saying to the Jews is, it doesn't matter who you say he is. I've written it down. He is the king of the Jews. What does that have to, I think there is a much deeper meaning here. I think what God is doing through Pilate, just like he did through Caiaphas, the high priest, when the high priest said about Jesus, he said, it's better for you that one man should die than the whole nation for to perish. And he was talking about just killing Jesus, murdering him. But John wrote that he was prophesying and he didn't even know it. God was working through the religious leaders, his perfect plan. Pilate was prophesying, I believe, and he didn't even know it. What he's saying here, and he's saying this not just to the Jews, but he's saying this to the world now, to all of us through the scriptures, is it doesn't matter who you think this Jesus is. He is king. He is king. Now that is significant, because remember Pilate with his what is truth? Mr. Relativity himself says, what I have written, I have written. It doesn't matter if you think he is your king or not. This is Jesus, the king of the Jews. What do we do with that? Friends, a couple of things. First, I want to say to you that if you are here this morning, or if you are hearing the sound of my voice, and you're not a Christian, and you are exploring the claims of Christianity, it is so true that we live in this pluralistic society. We live in this relativistic society that says all roads lead to heaven. You have your truth. I have my truth. But the reality is, like Pilate's sign says, this is indeed the king. Not just of the Jews, but of the entire world. It was written in Aramaic, it was written in Latin, and it was written in Greek. That was the known world for them at the time. And friends, this language is written today in English, it's written in Chinese, it's written in Spanish, it's written in Arabic. The truth is that this is the reality for everybody in this world. No matter what you believe, no matter your worldview, no matter what God or religious system that you believe in, Jesus is saying it, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody comes to the Father except through me. It does not matter who you say or think Jesus is. He is the king. This is why after he was raised from the dead, after he was resurrected, he told his disciples to go into all the world to make disciples of all nations. All nations throughout the world, to go and to tell them that he is king. The message of the cross is that Jesus has died for the sins of the world. He is the only way to salvation and forgiveness and relationship with God. And this way is available to everybody if you would come and acknowledge that you are a sinner, that Jesus died on the cross for your sins, that he is the only means by which we can be forgiven, and you commit your life to following him. Now you may say, but why, Ulysses, should I follow this man who was crucified on a Roman cross? He lost. He died. He suffered. Why should I follow him? I mean, why shouldn't I follow a God that never had to die? A God that never suffered? A God that was always strong? Why should I follow your crucified Savior? Because everything that happened to Jesus happened according to the will and the plan of God. God knew that this would happen because this was a part of God's plan to save humanity. Jesus did not go to the cross because things got out of control, because he couldn't handle the situation. Jesus went to the cross willingly to die for the sins of humanity. This is why here, even when the soldiers divided his clothes among each other, what does John say? John says that this was to fulfill prophecy. David wrote this in Psalm 22, 1,000 years before the time of Jesus. King David was going through a really tough time, and he said, "They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing, they cast lots." David was saying, "I'm in a real bad place, and it feels like I'm gonna die, like I'm gonna be crucified, like my life is going to end." But what David did not fully realize is that he was talking about the coming Messiah, the son of David, the true king of Israel, and what would happen to him. That Jesus would die upon a cross, and that even his clothing would be split amongst the guards. In fact, Jesus, he fulfilled hundreds and hundreds of prophecies in the Old Testament. Alfred Edersteen, a theologian, wrote, he believes 456 Old Testament prophecies Jesus fulfilled. J. Barton Payne says 574. If we're going to be really conservative about it, Jesus fulfilled at least 300 prophecies in the Old Testament about what he would do, about who he would be. God knew from the very beginning what would take place. Jesus went to the cross willingly. Friends, the cross is the ultimate sign of the grace and the mercy of God. It says, this is what we all deserved, but Jesus took our punishment. And if we would believe in him, we experience forgiveness. We experience relationship with God. But the cross is also a warning. A cross is a warning that says nobody, can live a life without sin. Nobody can live a perfect life so as to avoid the punishment and the judgment of God. And the judgment of God is what awaits everybody who thinks that they can stand on their own righteousness. Somebody who can stand before God and say, "God, I've been perfect my whole life. I've never sinned. There is no sin of Adam, no original sin within me. I have been perfect." No one will ever be able to stand before God. And the cross stands as a warning as well, that the judgment of God upon sin is real. It is the ultimate sign of the love and the grace of God, and also the judgment and the punishment of God. And they came together upon the person of Jesus. Friends, Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody comes to the Father except through me." This message was broadcast to all the world, Latin, Aramaic, and Greek. And now, as the Bible is being translated to every language around the world, as Christians labor to do that, it is because God is saying, this is the only means of salvation, and it is for you. It is for everybody here. Friends, if you have never put your faith in Jesus, God is inviting you to trust in the resurrected Son of God who died on the cross, but was raised from the dead so that you can be a child of God. Now, this is also, let me speak for a moment here too, before we close, to those who are Christians, to the believers here in this room, and that is most of us, myself included. There is a deep challenge here as well in this passage. And the challenge is this, that when Jesus told us, when he said to the people in the Gospels, "Anybody who wants to be my disciple must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." When he said to you, if you want to be with me, if you want to be a Christian, you need to be willing also to take up your cross, your patibulum, and to carry it with you towards the place of crucifixion. What Jesus... That has become so trite. That has become so cliche. We all know about it. So many of us, right? Myself included in the past, I've worn a cross necklace and it's gold or it's silver. It's this beautiful piece of jewelry. But it is actually a sign of horror. It is a sign of horror, a sign of torture and shame that we need to remember that's what it means. Jesus is saying, is anybody who wants to be a believer, you need to take up your cross and be willing to follow me. You need to be willing to identify with the shame of the cross. You need to be where I am. Now, this is such an important thing to remember, because how often do we live believing a lie? Believing a lie that if I could just make the gospel of Jesus palatable enough for non-believers around me, for the society around me, if I could just do that, then I won't be persecuted. I could proclaim the gospel and not need to experience shame and suffering because I don't want that. I don't want that. To believe the lie that I can be so knowledgeable, I could be so intellectual, I could be so good at apologetics that people would be forced to say, you know what? You are so right. How could I criticize you? How could I make you feel ashamed of believing this? This is the most sensible, logical thing in the world. I have nothing against apologetics. I think it's really, really good. But if we buy into that, we're buying into a lie. And we will never open our mouths. Some of us buy into the lie to think that, you know what? I'm going to be so nice. I'm going to be the nicest, sweetest, most loving person in the world, as you should be. But I'm going to be so nice that when I tell people about Jesus, there's no way they can make fun of me or criticize me. They'll feel so ashamed to do that because they'll say, but you're so nice. I can't ridicule you for believing in Jesus. I can't say anything against you. You're the nicest person I know. If that's what you believe, you will never open your mouth because it will never happen. It won't. Jesus said, go into all the nations. You are to be the sign upon you. Upon your life that reads, Jesus is King. That sign on top of his cross is the sign that is upon your life. Wherever you go, whether Jerusalem, in Aramaic, in Greek, in Latin, or if you're a missionary to the ends of the earth, or you're just in your workplace, the sign on your life reads, Jesus is King. You are the sign. Bible, Paul says, you are Christ's ambassadors, as if God were making his appeal through you to this world. Jesus is King. But the reality is, most people will reject that. Most will. The way is narrow that leads to eternal life, and few people find it. More often than not, you will be rejected. But there will be those, God's sheep, who hear the voice of the shepherd. Friends, Christians, are you willing to declare, he is my King? Jesus is King. Jesus of Nazareth is not only King of Israel, he is the King of the world. He is the King of the universe. A part of being his disciple means a willingness to go to the cross, to go to the place of shame, because we know this world is not our home. Let me conclude with this. I'm going to invite the worship team and the prayer team up at this time as well as we move into a time of response. I want to conclude with this. In Hebrews chapter 2, still, can we go back to the sermon slides? In Hebrews chapter 2, here, the author of Hebrews, he also quotes from Psalm 22, the one that John quoted from just now here as well. And in this passage, he writes, for he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source. That is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers, saying, I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing your praise. Again, referring to Psalm 22, what this is talking about is Jesus. And the reality is that Jesus was not ashamed to call us his brothers, to call you his brother, his sister, because when he went to the cross, through his shed blood, through the shame and the suffering that he endured, his blood washed away your sin. He sanctified you so that now you are robed in robes of righteousness. And he is not ashamed to say, this is my brother, this is my sister. He's not ashamed to stand before the Father in heaven and say, these are your children, Father, because my blood has washed them clean. If anybody should be ashamed, brothers and sisters, it should have been Jesus to come and walk amongst the people who have soiled themselves with sin and rejected the way of God. But he came and he identified with us to make us holy. Brothers and sisters, now as Christians, will you identify with God? As Paul said in Romans chapter 1, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek.